Cooper comes up, hits it. Yes!
It's astonishing! It's Lee Griffiths!
Bogleach. Where's the goal?
Cuthbert, she strikes. Goal! Erin Cuthbert!
Oh, what a goal! What a goal! What a goal by Mick Bardon!
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Official Scotland Podcast. We're here at the museum at Hampden Park this afternoon, joined by someone who knows what it's like to represent Scotland at a major finals. Kevin Gallagher, thanks for joining us. How are you?
I'm very well, Gordon, very well.
Good stuff. It makes sense to start at the beginning, take you a bit of a trip down memory lane. You were born in Clydebank. What are your early football memories, your early Scotland memories?
My early football memories is going about in Linville where like parents were there, we were brought up and playing on the football grass of Strauss Park, and that used to be our cup final pitch, playing on grass, because generally it was all playing on roads and growing up that way. And my early memories really were going standing outside Kilbowie and getting a lift over by an adult to get in and watch Clydebank playing, until I was old enough to get in a bus and come up into Glasgow and watch Celtic.
Any early Scotland memories, whether that be, I don't know, television or when you're on your cup final pitch thinking you've scored the winner for Scotland or whatever?
Oh,
it may
loads.
Be.
In my back garden, I had dreams as a kid. I used to duck and dive under the sort of ropes for mum used to hang the washing, and I was Scotland versus Brazil in the World Cup final. That was my dream, to play Brazil in the World Cup final, and it was phenomenal. One day I would hope to get there, see what it was going to take us.
Now, the debut comes in 1988. It's only a week after you score in the Scottish Cup final. So to have that all happen within the 1 week must have been incredible.
It was unbelievable to be in a cup final, and then the next day get a phone call and getting called into the squad was really weird, because you were kind of down and thinking, oh, I can't believe I've lost the cup final. But on the other hand, it was like, wow, I'm going to be joining up with the squad. And for me, it was really exciting, you know, forget about losing the cup final. It was a new chapter for me, and I just basically puffed the chest out and thought, I've got to get rid of this and go and be excited, and I was.
To put you right on the spot, I wonder if you could remember the other 10 guys who were there when you made your debut. Luckily, I've got them written down. I've got the comfort of that. But
no, you could tell me. No, all I remember that debut against Colombia was the fact is that I remember shouting to Gordon Strachan to turn. And unfortunately, it was a Colombian behind him, actually wiped him out. And the wee man turned round and absolutely berated me. I don't think I'll ever forget that. Just the look in his face, I thought, I ain't shouting again. So I kind of went a little bit more quieter.
I'll check back in at the end and see if they've come back to you a bit later on. You jumped about a bit between sort of being a winger and a centre-forward early on. Did you have a preference, or was it just a case of playing wherever you were asked?
Ideally, as a kid, I played like a number 10 role in today's football. That's where I like playing, that's where I scored a lot of goals. At junior level, more a centre midfielder. But when I went to Dundee United at 16, I was still tiny. I was still very frail. I was weighing in at something like 8 stone. And Jim McLean just thought, I don't think you're going to be a centre midfielder for me. But you're quick, you're skillful. You're going to have to play in the wing. And it was really weird, because at 16... I was pigeonholed into that centre midfield position where I scored lots of goals. But I had to start a new career at 16. So really I had 2 years to learn a new trade. But what a better place to learn it when I had people like Ralph Millen, Graham Payne, Alec Taylor, all right wingers. And then to add to that, people like Paul Sturrock to look up to as a forward in a similar style to what I play. So for me, my upbringing with these guys, even sitting watching for 2 years, having to watch them, because I lost a year between 16 and 17 because I never played a game. All I'd done was study them in football. So for me, it was massive growing time. But to have the 1 year, 17, 18, to try and establish yourself, it was a big challenge for me.
After the excitement of the debut, then it gets even more exciting, arguably. Your second game is at Wembley against England. I think you were a sub for Ali McCoist. What's that like to play in that arena in only your second game for the national team?
Well, put it this way. Normally when you go and you're a sub, you sit on the bench and you watch the game. I went and sat down and Tommy Burns just got up and went away for a warm-up for my first minute. And I thought, oh, I wonder if that's what you do with a national team. So I just followed Tommy Burns. And we actually stood behind the goals, and we actually watched the fans berating each other at Wembley. and we've seen some fighting and everything going on there. It was unbelievable, but the atmosphere was, it was something that I thought, wow, this is never going to be beaten, a Scotland-England game. And it wasn't the hatred in it, it was just the rivalry. It was unbelievable. And I stood there and with Tommy Burns and we're watching it. We turned around, we watched the game, and I just basically followed Tommy Burns. Whatever he'd done, I just followed him like a little puppy dog. And the second half, when I got called back and you're going on, like, it was just a bag of nerves. But I had an opportunity, and Peter Shilton pulled off a great save, and eventually a good friend of mine, Kenny Sanson, who I ended up playing against. It was just unbelievable. I just remember these memories are phenomenal, and it's just a shame that Peter Shilton pulled off a great save that day.
Tommy wouldn't have been a bad person to learn off of anyway.
Oh, I tell you, I'd never seen it before. I'd never seen a substitute warm up from the first minute. Basically, go and sit down, and as soon as you sit down, it was get up and back out and go and run about. And I thought, this must be what you have to do at the national team. So I just got up and followed him, and I just stood at the side, and we were watching it, just like photographers right beside them, watching the game, watching the fans. And we were just being a fan, really, and they're doing a warm-up without it, because the adrenaline, the buzz, to be fair, I didn't need a warm-up. I was ready to go on.
Such is the nature of international football. It was 2.5 years between caps 4 and 5, and I don't mind giving away a bit of a trade secret. When we said this to you before we started recording, you were amazed. You couldn't believe that, you know, looking back on it, there was such a long period between caps.
I can't, you know, it's when I look back in it, and I look back to when you get your first caps and you think, wow, that's me, I'm in about it. But I knew I was only in there for the fact is that players had pulled out on injury, and I'd gotten in merit. Obviously, the way you play in the cup finals was a massive factor. And I got in, so it was just a case of holding that place. I did have a little bad time with Jim McLean at the time, and I wasn't playing, and I remember Andy Roxburgh basically saying to me as well, you need to be playing regularly. So I left Dundee United to go to Coventry because I knew I'd be playing regularly. But unfortunately, it was null and void, really. It was, for me, a little bit of lies to me to keep me going. And unfortunately, it sent me right down the pecking list.
When Euro 92 comes around, though, what's that feeling like? Because you don't need me to remind you, there is a generation of Scottish footballers who don't know what it's like to be called up to a major tournament. What's it like when the call comes?
When you're on that list, it's unbelievable, you know. And Sweden was just phenomenal to go there. But the teams you had, we had Holland, Germany, and Russia. You know, just to be part of that squad to get out there was brilliant. I wasn't a young player at the time. I was kind of getting to that stage where I should have been chatting at the door and challenging players. But I didn't open the campaign. I sat on the bench for the first couple of games and we didn't get the results. And of course, you get to the final game, it's just going, got my opportunity. And for me, it was only game we won, so I can have a little bit of claim to fame in that. But no, it was brilliant. The experiences is, you got to go to these competitions, you know, and people kept saying to us, like, no, I mean, Scotland's not getting any good, you're all getting older. You'll never qualify for these competitions again. But we proved a lot of people wrong in doing it, and getting to Euro 92 was magnificent.
Now, obviously, in a situation where, you know, you would be happy to be there, but were there genuine expectations that you could do something within that group? I mean, to be fair, the opposition you mentioned were pretty strong, but did you still go there with expectations?
I think, personally, I think you've got to go everywhere with expectations. I don't think I approached any game that I ever played in with a national team with a view that, oh, we're going to get beat here, just give it the best shot. I always gave it the fact that we could beat this lot, we could beat them, we could make a name for ourselves and win. And I think we did that in Euro 92. And we weren't that far away, to be fair, in the games. We played really well. It's just one or two times we just don't have the luck to get over the hurdle.
Maybe a sign of the times, but I think you were one of only four English-based players in the squad at that time. How do you remember that squad as a whole in terms of how strong it was, how it compared to other squads you were in?
To be fair, it's gone back so long, like, if I had time to have thought about it, I would have been able to go right into it in depth. But to be fair, I think the main squad that I take upon now was the 98 World Cup squad. That's the one I could probably go through. I say it's 92, 94, 96. Like, some of them are actually a little bit of a blur. You're looking at the players, but when you are actually mainly on the bench, everything is, because you're concentrating on other things that you forget what the reality of playing is.
Being away with the national team at that time, though, how different was it? I mean, what do you do? Because when we speak to the current players, it's PlayStations and Netflix and whatever else.
It's not changed.
How did you guys keep yourself out of trouble back in
92? Basically, that was it. Especially, I mean, the main one I remember, the cultural thing, was at 98 World Cup. And basically we went to San Remy and we turned the hotel into a house. 6 months, eight, maybe even 10 months before, Craig and the management team had approached each individual player. What did you want for home comforts? What did you want that basically that you would thrive for at home? What could you get? And the lads said, this is what I want. They went away, gave it to someone who obviously looked into it in depth and dressed up the hotel in comparison for us. So, I mean, we turned the swimming pool area, half of it was into a gymnasium. We had, obviously, we had the PlayStation area as well, because obviously PlayStation was one of the big sponsors. So we got PlayStation, so we got an area that we put that in. So there was all different things. It was all just made to make it feel like you were walking inside your house.
Going back to the 92, how do you look back on it then? You mentioned that it perhaps is a bit of a blur compared to 98, but for it to be the first one and that first experience, what are your sort of overall recollections of it?
It went too quickly. I think if I could turn back the clock and do it again, I think I would take more in.
Do you mean they kind of take it for granted at the time?
Yeah, I wouldn't say take it for granted. I just think that you got there and you think, oh, this is it, we're here in Merritt. But it was just a case of the games were so quick and done that it wasn't absorb anything in. You're looking back, trying to find photographs and things like that for little memory things, and it's not. It's all in the head, and it's kind of strange. But the main memory that I remember is basically playing in the last game, and then that was it. We were going home. We had a meal, a beautiful restaurant, and basically that was it. End of night, back on the bus the next morning, and we were away back home again.
What was Andy Roxburgh like as a manager?
Andy was brilliant. I can't say anything about it, because Andy, we had the 21s as well. So for me personally, growing up, it does help when people know what you're like as a player as well. And Andy seen that. He knew, having spoke to Jim McLean as well, that the positions that I could play, I was covering basically anywhere across the front. So you were kind of a utility right across the front. And for that, he gave me that opportunity. I think they were just waiting, like what Jim McLean was, waiting for me to develop into a man's body. And it just wasn't happening. And it was just me, that was my physique. My physique was to be small, to be frail, to be fast. That was it. It was just get on with it. And as Jim McLean did, he just said, doesn't matter your size, if you're good enough, you'll play. And that's what happened.
If we fast forward to the qualification for USA 94, maybe not quite so many happy memories. How do you reflect on that period?
Well, that's a bypass. That's a miss. For me, that's a miss. And I, for the whole campaign to go to America, my head is just like goes poof, and it just goes into a big cloud.
I'll try and jog some memories. Yeah. We're all right here at Hampden. You know, at home it wasn't the problem, it was on the road. Did you ever remember maybe playing for Scotland and noticing the difference, noticing how much harder it was to go and do the business on the road compared to when you came back here?
I think the differences of today's game compared to our game was, like, now we've got the media, it shows everything in every country. All the best players from all the weaker countries are now playing in different countries and getting better. And that's a big difference. We played in the era of, for me, it was surprise packages. You didn't. You go and play Romanians, and you hadn't a clue about half of them. But they were top players. They were top Romanian teams. And you just thought, well, they can't be that good because we don't know who they are. And that's just a fact. Now you know every single one. Now, and that's just, it's a harder factor now.
Do you remember the 5-0 away in Portugal? I think it was the biggest loss
you
were involved. We're going to do the good stuff, so you have to balance out with the bad stuff.
Yeah, no, I think that one, to me, the biggest disappointment was that was Coiste. You know, it's what a player he was, and he broke his leg. And for me, we forget the result. I know everybody would get slaughtered for it. It was a bad day at the office, but when you lose one of your key players to an injury, it was a bad injury. I think everybody just, their heart sank, and it kind of just made the whole occasion a bad day.
How much are players aware of the bigger picture as well? Because maybe it was the beginning of the end for the manager at the time, but you guys can sort of get your own jobs to focus on. Are you aware of the bigger picture?
No, you're only aware basically of what you're doing, and it's a kind of selfish thing. You just want to do what you do. You want to get yourself in and get playing, and then get within that team and in that squad you want to stay there. I don't think you'd pay too much interest in the manager and what they're doing in that sense. You know, the results are down to the 11 that play, or the 16 or 14, whatever it is, that are on that pitch, and you've got partly to blame for it, and you take it in the chin. But unfortunately, it's a manager that's next on the line, and that's what happens. And you can carry on, the manager doesn't, and sometimes you feel disappointed at that time, but you've just got to pick yourself up and get on, because you've got a new manager who'll come in and you've got to impress him, because he might think, well, I don't really fancy him because he let him down. So you've got to impress him now.
Now, we did promise you we would do good memories. So the next game, you score your first Scotland goal against Estonia. Do you remember that?
Pink shot.
Talk us through it.
Yeah, salmon pink shot. Can't forget it. And I nearly missed it as well. I hit my heel. Okay. Oh, I tell you, I didn't care. I just wanted the first goal. If it hit my backside and gone in, it did not matter to me. It was just you kept trying and trying. It wasn't happening. You're in the squads and all of a sudden all your cap counts are up, and they're up at something, I don't know, it was like 20 caps or whatever it is, and you're not scoring and you're getting stick for being a forward, and you're thinking, if you put all my minutes together, I probably played 3 games. And just to get that goal was just the biggest weight of the whole nation off your back, and you kind of think, thank goodness for that.
Colin Hendry makes his debut in that game. That's obviously a player you came to know very well. What was he like as a man and a player during your Scotland career?
You know, well, I knew Colin. He was at Dundee, I was at Dundee United. So we've been big rivals all the way through then. We've been teammates and we've been roommates for the national team and things. And you know, it was fantastic to see his career change, because I'd seen him as a player that wanted to be a centre-forward, then wanted to be a centre-half, but wasn't quite working for him. And then seen Kenny Dalglish turn his career around for him and make him into one of the best centre-halves in England, and even in Scotland as well. But the whole English game, and he had the respect of it, because Kenny said to him, I don't want goals now. If you're a defender, defend. And Colin would run through a brick wall, and that was only training. When it came to a game, it's 2 brick walls. And he just didn't care. That he always said, I'll train the way I play, so don't stop me and don't have a go at me. And fair dues to him, if you're going to do that the way he done it, it was magnificent.
Does that mean you were on the receiving end of a few kicks in training?
I knew how to ride the tackle. Today it's classed as diving, but I knew how to ride the tackle. But no, you knew Colin. I mean, when you're with someone for so long, you get to know people's strengths, people's weaknesses and that, and playing against it. You knew when to take things and when not. In training, we knew what Colin would do. You knew he'd go through the back of you. We knew he'd come down the side of you. You knew how to handle it, but if you didn't take it from Colin, you were going to take it from someone else in the league. So the best way of learning for yourself was taking it from your own teammate.
Who were the other players over the years in the Scotland squad that you perhaps became particularly close with? Whether it be, you know, you mentioned roommates and team, but you know, you're joining up with guys who are maybe your rivals or guys you recognise from other teams.
I mean, I shared the room with Brian Gunn. No, I was Big Gunny's roommate at the early doors, and Big Brian Gunn, and obviously he came down to England as well. I came down, and you're playing against each other. Derek White, because the two of us were young together, we kind of shared the room as well. So from that point of view, and I think sometimes when you have teammates, then that's when you kind of got put together, and that's when basically me and Colin ended up going together as Blackburn Rovers teammates.
The second goal comes against Italy. Is there a bittersweet element to that, where you score again for Scotland, that's against one of the footballing superpowers, if you like, but obviously you lose the game? Where's the bittersweet balance?
Well, the bittersweet balance was scoring against Italy in Italy. I think it was only at that stage, it was John Gregg, I think, was the only person that had ever scored against them, and it was kind of thinking, well, somebody's got to score against them, it's got to break somehow. But to go to Italy against them, they were a magnificent team, you know, and we'd played them in friendlies in my early career, and they were getting stronger players coming through as well. So just to play in that game was, I thought we'd done really well. I don't think that the result really merited, I think it was 3-1. Didn't merit that result. I think we played better than that, but we only put the one opportunity away. It's just the fact is that Italy had that little bit of extra gear, and by using that, they got a couple of goals that surprised us, really.
I mean, they then went on to be runners-up in the World Cup, so it shows the level they were at. Would they be the toughest team you played against in your Scotland career, or one of?
One of. You know, I think when we'll go forward probably to the 98 World Cup, I think you've got to look at that with Brazil. But Italy, certainly, in the 90s, watching Italian football on the television, it was always seems to be very, very difficult to break Italian teams down. And to actually play against them and have, like, you know, I mean, Costa Curta, I mean, Franco Baresi, Bergomi, all these guys, and basically winding you up and telling you, like, do you not feel like you're tired by running about? I was like, no. It was just one of those things. He says, oh, but we're 1-3-1 and you're just chasing. So you're never going to get it. And it was just kind of, it was very different to other nations that we played against.
Is that something maybe fans don't appreciate about these good sides, that they do have that sort of nasty side as well. They're more than happy to mix it.
I mean, the nasty side of football, basically for me, is European. I got it in my early years at Dundee United, and you learned about it. You would go around Europe and play in European competition, and I remember going to Romania, and it was horrible. You know, they all turned up with khaki outfit on, and it was really, really strange. And the players were nipping your neck, they were spitting at you, they were spitting in the back of your head, and you're trying to concentrate, and you're thinking, no, I just want to hit this boy. And you know, I mean, that's the way it is. They just distract you. They're the masters of it, and they do it all over Europe. And Italy are no different. Italy were, at that stage, a fantastic football side, but they were forever just touching your shoulder, so you just looked around, and as you looked around, they nipped in front, took the ball off you, and away they went. So they were very, very clever at the game. And then on the other hand, when you went to hit them in a tackle, they would dive over, roll, scream, and you think, I've not even touched them, and you get yellow carded. And that's been in the game for years and years and years, and it's just that we can't do it in Britain because we were so used to being brought up and stand up and take it in the chin and get on with it. And they were masters at it, and I think we're trying to learn from it, and it's not quite working.
Trying our best. Right, let's move on to Euro 96 then, of that transition between Andy Roxburgh and Craig Brown. Craig comes in, what's he like as a manager?
Craig was brilliant. You know, he just basically carried it on. Andy had started it, and Craig had just then basically confirmed what he was wanting to do with his squad, and the way that he wanted to do the whole thing was turn it into a club, a football club, not the national team. And he wanted to build basically 17 players, and then the rest who were playing in Forum at the time would come into that squad and try and build something like that. And to be fair, I was just happy that I was actually part of it, because his philosophy behind it all was relaxed, but it was graft hard and work at it, and the work ethic was you would play to the strengths of what we had at that time, and that's what he did.
Some players would struggle to cope with one leg break. You managed two and in around that time. How did you cope with that at the time, and maybe looking back on it psychologically, how difficult is it as a player to deal with that?
How long have we got?
As long as you want.
When I'd done it the first time, I broke at Arsenal, and I'd never done anything bad before. All the little niggly injuries, I'd never had anything major. But when that came along, the surgeon, John Hodgkinson at the time, was brilliant. He was basically, he didn't know me really as a person, so he had to find out what I was like as a person and get in my head. I think he found out after the Arsenal game when I said I didn't want to go to the hospital in London to get my leg fixed. I wanted to come home. So it was kind of crazy to do that, but I did it. I basically went to the hospital in London. They back-casted my leg, and I sat in the back of the bus going back to Blackburn playing cards with the boys. So it was kind of mad to do that and not just stay in London, go to the hospital, get my leg sorted there and then. But he kind of thought, oh, this is kind of hardy person, and he just, with the first operation, it didn't work, it kept springing out, and then with the second operation, he put the pin in the leg, got it there, and happy days, he basically said 3 months, and I thought, yes, I'll be back in 3 months. 3 months passed, there was nowhere near anything, and I kind of said to him, why are you telling me 3 months? I've been grafting, I'm in the gym, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. I says, I can't even kick or anything, I've still got this pot on, what do you do? And he just says, no, it'll be another 3 months. And I thought, well, 3 months till like the last 3 months, or we'll be able to do something. No, so he's about another 3 months. So it was like 6 months before really, by the stage I wasn't even allowed to kick the ball. So in that stage, I was back on AstroTurf, I was back in the gym, and I was kicking the ball all left-footed. And it basically turned me into a left footer. So when it was time to come back, I was trying to do things with my right foot, and I was turning off it and doing it with my left. And Kenny kept giving me stick. What are you doing? Get the ball in. I says, well, for some reason, I'm turning back and crossing it. I don't know. And I think basically I really, really made myself left footed. And then it was just mentally getting my head back round the confidence. And as I said, the surgeon had me there at least once, maybe twice a month, talking about it. Seeing what I felt about it, and I think within 10 months I was back playing reserve football. I've been back playing 2 months in reserve football, and then my first game back, I couldn't believe it. I thought, I'm back, we're going to win the league, we're on a chance of winning the league in England. I've got myself, I'm playing in the team, come back, score a goal, what a way to come back. And about 20 minutes later I was back on the table in the hospital again, so it was good. It was hard, but mentally, I wish I had have switched off when I first broke my leg and gone away for 3 or 4 weeks and just disappeared. I believed that I could get back quicker, and it never happened. So for me, I started it, but in hindsight, I got to Euro 96, World Cup 98. And when I got to World Cup 98, John Hodgkinson then revealed to me that I should never have played again. So for me to do that with a broken leg, that just shows the mental toughness that I must have had.
Absolutely. I mean, was Craig Brown the type to stay in touch during that period? Because international football is funny that way. It comes and goes every couple of months. But
I don't think
Craig
I ever got a phone
touch?
Call off Craig. Craig's phone calls generally went to the club, and then it came, all the news of generally came from the club to you as a player. Because in our day, we didn't really have the mobile phones, so it was a little bit hard. It was tom-tom drums and things like that.
when Euro 96 comes around, you've obviously missed the qualification period for it. Did you think you could still make the squad?
No, not at all. I was getting back into the swing of things. I don't think I was 100% ready to go back into that level of football, if I'm going to be honest. But I thought, well, there's an outside chance that anything could happen, I don't know. But then I turned the clock back to 1990 when I believed I could have gone, or should have gone to the World Cup in 90 and got left out of the squad. So for me, I kind of thought, well, hedge your bets, you're not going to Euro 96, forget it. It's a little bit too early. But when the squads came out, I couldn't believe it. I just thought, wow. I thought, now the hard work begins. I can't believe it. It's a big road to recovery. But as soon as I got that call, I had to work twice as hard to actually get to a level that I thought I was going to be at. And when I played against Holland, and I know I was playing against a teammate in Richard Vitschka, I knew he wasn't the quickest player in the world, but I thought I just wasn't ready. I wasn't even at the level. And I knew I would sit out the next couple of games in the campaign, and that was the downside of it.
Does that make the natural disappointment then of not being involved in those games, was it a bit easier to swallow because you expected
definitely.
It yourself?
Oh, yeah. I think if I'd have been fit and had the bad game against Holland and then just been dropped for the next two, I think I'd have been absolutely gutted. I knew the factor of where I was lucky actually being that team against Holland. I tried to grab it with both hands, but I only got it with the fingertips, unfortunately. And I knew then that my opportunity for the next game is going to be a hard one. So I just thought I might just grab on to maybe getting the Switzerland game at the end, but it wasn't to be. And the disappointing thing was it was actually in my hometown at that time, because in 96 we were based in Stratford-upon-Avon, and that's where I lived at that time. So everything was running about where I lived, so all my neighbours were coming round to watch training and see everything. So from that point of view, it was fantastic for me, but as I said, it was just a disappointment. It was just slightly too early for a campaign for me.
Is that the overriding emotion from it then? Because you maybe would think that you were just delighted to have made it and get there, but is it more of a frustration that having been there, you just weren't quite at the level you would have wanted to be?
I think so. When that squad got announced, I believed I was at the level. I thought, yes, I'm back. It wasn't until I went training again and with the lads, and you think, wow, because no doubt about it, the bunch of lads that we had with Scotland were fit guys. You know what I mean? Nobody can take that away from us. We were a fit team. So when I got back into that, I knew against the Blackburn lads compared to the Scottish lads, I'd be able to judge my fitness and levels. And I thought, wow, I've got a big way to come back to get to the level where I once was. And I knew it. But the opportunity of playing in the matches, I was sharp, I was alert. But when you take that step up, and people don't believe it, but when you take a step up, even at international level, just to take that one little step higher was quite difficult. And that's what I found in the game. I found the game that, which I shouldn't have done, because I played against Richard in training every day for the past X amount of months. But yet, I found it like so fast. It was unbelievable. So I kind of thought, oh, maybe I'm not there. And I was trying to get something out of me to get that level to get up, and I just couldn't do it on a day.
The qualification campaign for France 98 is next up then, and does that experience give you an added incentive? I don't know if you ever need an added incentive to get to a World Cup, but do you know what I mean? Does it add that little 1% given what you went through to Euro 96 to really want to get
did,
to the next one?
I didn't start the campaign. You know, people forget that, and I was down because I thought, oh God, if anything, I should get in. And no disrespect to other strikers and things like that, I believe they should have been in there. And I wasn't starting the campaign, and I just thought, right, just get your head down, work hard. This could be, this is going to be your last opportunity. I think I was around about 31, 32, I think, at the time when it started. And I thought, right, how are we going to do it? Right, just get your head down, work hard. And that's what I'd done at Blackburn. Got my head down, worked hard, and grafted. And you just wait for that opportunity with a national team. And when it comes along, take it. And fortunate for me, this time, when that opportunity came, I grabbed it with both hands, cuddled it, and wouldn't let it go. And for me, Lady Luck was on my side. I started scoring goals, and scoring goals regularly. But the downside was, I ended up getting a double hernia, and I wasn't training at Blackburn. But I had to train with the national team, and I struggled. And
that was
the downside. It didn't go down too well with Craig, because Craig was always, you need to train in front of the media to show them that you're fit. And I went, Craig, I'm not fit though. I can play in games, but I can't train. And that was the downside of it all. And I knew that if I trained, I would struggle in the matches. But I put it off till after World Cup, and I got through it. But as I said, the hardest part was in the games, because I had to play a game, then I had to train, and then I had to play a game, which I hadn't done for 6 months at Blackburn. But with Scotland, I had to do it, and it kind of took a lot of away from what I could do.
On the plus side, that must go down as your, I don't know, if it, your best period in a Scotland shirt. I think 6 of your 9 goals come in that qualification period. Yeah. Is that the, the period you look back on?
Oh, that's, for me, yes. You know, I think at that stage we were getting called Dad's Army, useless, you're too old now. Everybody was getting it. We were, and we knew it ourselves, but we knew, heart of hearts, we never had anybody behind us to come up and take our positions. But we never took it for granted, because we were, as Craig had built this club side now, and it was very, very difficult to break into it. And that's what it done. And what we'd done together, we'd done it together. You know, if somebody was kind of pushing me about, somebody else would come in and look after me, get rid of the opposition. That's the way we worked. We worked as a team. It wasn't individuals, you're on your own. We worked as a team, and I think that's what got us to these campaigns. It was togetherness that we had was unbelievable.
Also pretty hard to beat back then as well. Your priority, as we just touched on, is scoring these goals, but was there a real toughness at the other end for teams to try and break us down?
Well, with 3 centre-halves, or in some cases it was 5 centre-halves we had actually as wing-backs, but we knew that 3 centre-halves were playing at the top of the game. We knew 3 centre-midfielders were playing at the top of their game. That was our strengths, and we had myself, Gordon Dewery and Darren Jackson. So 2 out of the 3 were playing, scoring goals. We're all scoring goals at our clubs. So realistically, down the spine of the side, we were strong. But the strength of our side was defensive, and that's the way that Craig wanted us. So we ended up 3-5-2, but it was a 5-3-2 we played, and it was very much counter-attacking football. And we just relied a lot on the pace of the defenders. So we defended, sucked everything in, stopped everything, and then bang, we caught teams on the break, and we caught some of the best teams on the break, and we hurt some of the best teams as well.
Yeah, one of the standouts would be the Sweden game at Ibrox, the 1-0, I think it was Jim Leighton inspired. Do you remember much of it that day?
Yeah, I was sitting on the bench. Thanks for bringing that up.
You got a good view of him, though.
It's a great view. John McGinley scoring a goal, and I mean, it was brilliant, and I just thought, wow, this, I mean, just to be part of it again, that was it. But that stage, I was wanting back in the team. I should be in the team. How am I going to get back in? And you're watching it, and then John scores a goal. You're thinking, no, I'm not going to get in for the next game either. So it was one of those things that you just wanted, the selfish thing came into yourself. I want to go and play there, and I want to be part of this team and wait my chance. And when your chance comes, you've got to take it. And we did. And I mean, that game, to be fair, the excitement in that game was unbelievable. The atmosphere at Ibrox was phenomenal. But at that stage, we didn't have Hampden Park. We were playing between Ibrox and Celtic Park and doing that. And unfortunately for me, all my campaign goals end up, it seemed to be at Celtic Park. And I think there was a destiny in there somewhere, but it never ever happened.
We've done the good, we've done the bad. What about the downright bizarre? Talk to us about Estonia. Now, you weren't involved in the original game, but by the time the rearranged game in Monaco comes around, you're involved. Talk us through that. What's the build-up like? What are the players thinking?
It was really, really weird. I remember watching the game on TV, and you're reading about it, and they're not going to turn up. Nah, it can't happen. And you see the boys walking out on their own, and you think, that's bizarre. I mean, just to watch it, I just thought it was funny. It was almost as bad as your teammates fighting on the pitch and things like that. But, no, I mean, when the game came around and they went, right, we're taking it to Monaco, it has to be replayed, and to be fair, it was easy for us. It's going to be easy. It was. I think we approached it in the same mood. It's in Monaco. It's a lovely place. It's beautiful. We were training at Monaco's training ground. We're going to batter them, and it didn't work out. It just completely backfired on us, and I think we learned a valuable lesson, and it was not to take the poor teams too lightly.
You mentioned the Celtic Park factor to your Scotland goals. What about the Austria game? It was a double that night. I mean, that's you mentioned playing as a kid, jumping in between the clotheslines and dreaming of scoring for Scotland. You know, to score in a double in a game like that must have been incredible.
It was. I mean, I remember in the campaign, Paul Lambert had gone to Dortmund at the time, and he'd got into the Scotland setup, and he was telling us about centre sweeper. They played with a sweeper, Austria. And I was thinking, I never really played against a sweeper. So it's two centre-half marking you, and one sweeper that's almost standing beside the goalkeeper. And Paul was telling us about this lad, the centre-half, how he plays, etc. And so Craig, when he was doing the team talk, and myself and Darren, and how we had to play it and how we had to play the system, it was kind of weird because one of us had to, at all times, play as far up the park as we could. And that's what happened. You know, we were defending the instance for the first goal. We were all back in our half, and I've broke it up, and I've passed it to Darren, and Darren's just heard it away, and I thought, there was nobody else chasing it. I'll chase it. And lucky for me, as I chased it up, I seen Darren, and he shot, and I almost stopped, and I almost thought, oh, Darren, what are you doing? That was a goal. You should have scored. And it's come back off the goalkeeper, and I just kept going. And next minute, I knew the defender beat Darren to the ball, and all I'd done was run, and just thought, hit the net, just hit the net. And I've just kicked it, left-footed, hit the back of the net, and I just thought, where'd they celebrate? Which way did I go? And I just thought, I just lost it in my head. It was just, and the noise, the whole place was just bouncing. It was unbelievable because they were one of the favourites to beat us. And just to get that first goal, to settle the nerves and to hear the fans getting behind us was unbelievable.
When you look back on that campaign, so many different incidents. I mean, the Estonia's, that's a sort of one in a million shot. Then you've also got the Belarus game, which was moved due to Princess Diana's funeral. I mean, do you remember that period? Was there a bit of controversy around the game? Or, I mean, these are, like I say, one in a million circumstances for a footballer. How do you guys reflect on that?
I never really paid attention to that. If the game got cancelled, I just thought the game's cancelled, switch off and get on with the next thing. You know, it didn't pay to anything regarding what it was about. You just, I think, when you get called up for any game, your attention is to focus on the game. It's not surrounding activities unless it's surrounding what you're going to be doing within the match. So for me, around that time, I couldn't even have told you that stat.
There you go. We're back at Celtic Park again, though. We're really starting to see this theme developing. Latvia, qualification. How does that feel?
Nervous. We went into a Latvia game knowing that if we won, we'd have to wait in one result to give us an opportunity. Qualifying, and so we just give it our best shot. And to be fair, it was brilliant. You know, I mean, the butterflies in my stomach that day were probably the worst I've ever had. You know, it was one of them. I didn't want to eat my pre-match meal. I was so nervous. But we went out, and it was just like anything. You just need an opportunity, get an opportunity, and take an opportunity. And it was hard because the Latvians, even though it's kind of new country coming out, etc., it was. You've got to beat them, you've got to break them down. And we seem to struggle against these nations. And when we, Johnny Collins, pulled out a peachy, a strike, I just done what naturally came to me, and that was just run in. But when I ran in and I seen the ball rising and I thought, I ain't going to reach it, it's going to go right over my head, I just thought, just jump. And probably was the highest I've ever jumped. And just to head it back on target and get that goal massively settled the nerves. And I think it showed in that game because we all puffed our chest out and thought, right, now we've got the goal. Now we can relax and we can play properly, and that's what we did.
Are you able to give us a PG version of where the players went and how they celebrated after that one?
Well, I was in a hotel in Glasgow at that time.
Quiet one?
No. It was quiet at the time. We stopped in a hotel after a game, and we sat and we were waiting for the result. And when the result came through, it was basically, but to text the manager and say that we'd be in slightly later tomorrow.
Slightly,
and he just says, yeah, well, somebody had to drive back down the road quite sensibly. Unfortunately for myself and Colin, we'd family up as well, so we at least with someone else driving. But it was a late night, shall we say.
we'll leave it there. That sounds fine. That was PG enough. Before we even get to the World Cup, you've got all the madness that goes into something like that. The World Cup song, Delamitri, the music video. Was that your MTV debut? How do you look back on that? It must have been a bit bizarre.
I missed that one.
Gutted.
Yeah, no.
Biggest career regret, missing out in the music video.
Missing out in the music videos, yeah. That's the downside of it when you're doing these. And you get to, I mean, the ones that we've done with Rod Stewart and things like that, it's the ones I remember, but the Delamitri one I missed out, because I remember watching the video again, because I can't remember why I missed out on it as well. I think they maybe done it just with the Scottish lads, the ones that were based up here. I think that's when they done it, so rather than getting all of us. So basically they'd done it that side of it, but I just remember, I think it was Gordon Dury doing a bit on the video as well.
Stick to the day job.
Yeah, I think so.
When the opening game comes around against Brazil and they score early on, how are you feeling? You must still be delighted to be there and be part of it, but
we were still doing a warm-up then.
Fearing the worst of it.
It was unbelievable. Nobody really told us to the day before that we wouldn't be able to warm up on the pitch because obviously the event was going to happen. We're opening the World Cup, but I think we were just preparing as normal. We're going to go out, we'll warm up normal, we'll be nice and warm, stretched, blah, blah, blah. No, you've got a room 20 feet by 20 feet with a pillar in the middle. The goalkeeper's got to do a warm up, you've got to do running, we're sprinting down a corridor. Okay, same for both sides, but I think, struggled to come to terms with that mentally. I think that was it was like someone just painting over a window, so he couldn't just see out, and I think that was the downside of it. And when we went out and the atmosphere gets you, we just wanted to go on that grass and run about to get ready for the game. But as we'd done that, we'd kicked off. So the opening parts of the game and things that we hadn't done for the corner kick, for example, we'd never let teams score for set pieces in the whole campaign. I think we lost one set piece, I think, if we did. Never lost them. But yet, in the opening 15 minutes, we switched off because I believe that we were not ready in the opening 15 minutes of the game.
Does that perhaps impact you guys because you're up against Brazil and you're well aware that you need to be absolute optimum level and then all of a sudden your preparations are so disrupted? Do you think that was a real problem?
It was a problem at the time. Nobody sees that because nobody comes down the background and sees what you're going to be doing and how you warm up. At that time, everybody warmed up very, very similar. Then you went off and done your own thing. But we all had to try and mingle together in this room and get warm. And it was very, very difficult, as I said, to do it. You'd done the best that you could. And then the couple of minutes while the handshakes were going just before centre, you tried to get some sprint work done to really open your legs up. But I would definitely say the opening 15 minutes, we were on a slow build-up to get into the game, feeling what Brazil were going to be like and testing our tactics out against them. And I think the only good thing out of it that people got, I think Norway took the best, and Norway took our style of how we broke down Brazil. They took it into their game and they battered Brazil, and it was kind of strange. But they had 3 6-foot giants.
Helps. I've always wondered about the kilts, wondering if everybody was all on board with it or if people had to be convinced, shall we say. Which camp were you in?
Well, I was for the kilt. We spoke about it. I remember we had the meeting about it, and the only one really that wasn't going to wear a kilt was the gaffer, was Craig. He didn't want to wear the kilt. But the boys agreed to it. We all went, yes, we're all up for the kilt. No other national team has done it. We've done it. We all thought about, we're having a conversation, Dad's army, blah, 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 blah. Let's go and enjoy it. Let's go and do something for the nation, make them proud of us. And we couldn't tell anybody. They told the wives, you can't tell anybody what we've got to do. The only downside is we wish the kilts were a little bit lighter, because I think I must have lost about a stone walking about Saint-Denis before the game, just with the heat of the kilts. But it was what a massive experience it was just wearing them. It was brilliant.
When you eventually get the kilt off and you get on the field, you of course win the penalty that John Collins sticks. Just so we're clear, was it definitely a penalty?
Yeah.
You don't sound too convinced, if you don't mind me saying.
I don't like admitting it. I don't like saying it. I didn't really dive in my career. But against Sweden, I had a very, very similar opportunity to do the thing, and I stood up thinking, I can maybe get the ball and try and score here. It didn't happen. And it was an opportunity wasted, really. And that stuck in my head. So when it came across and I seen the ball going down, I thought, I can get to this ball. And I looked, and Taffarel was in the same line. And I thought, well, he's going to dive on it. I've got to try and get there. And all of a sudden, I just felt hands on my back. And as I felt the hands on my back, I didn't dive. I just fell over. And as I fell over, I basically just, the noise, I just thought, was that the whistle? And I looked up at the referee, and he was pointing at the spot. And I thought, who's taking penalties? I thought, am I taking penalties? I went, no. And I thought, oh, my God. And I looked around, and John Collins had the ball, peacocking, confident, and just walked away. And I thought, thank God, somebody's confident of taking the penalty, because he's nervous. And the wee man stood up and put it home. And from that, I thought, this is an opportunity, because Brazil had problems. Big problems. Ronaldo had problems. He wasn't playing the best. Rivaldo, I mean, some of the best players in the world. They're not the best players in the world. But we seen an opportunity, and we had our chances. We just didn't take them. And as I said, the two other nations, Morocco and Norway, done their homework, and Norway especially, and decided just to keep three up the park against the two fullbacks who went forward and beat them 4-1, I think they beat them. And that killed their campaign.
Where does the Morocco game go wrong? You mentioned earlier on about potentially at times or the dangers of underestimating opposition. Was that something that could be labelled at the Morocco game?
I think so, yeah.
Yeah.
I think we looked at the Moroccans as being very weak, probably weaker than Estonia, I think, personally. And we went out and underestimated them. They played football, they played us off the park, and we just couldn't take chances. We just couldn't get there. We couldn't get chances. And that's the disappointing thing. They were just so energetic. I just think they wanted it probably that little bit more than what we did. We thought, this is it, it's an opportunity. If we beat them, we could qualify, because Brazil's going to beat Norway. And it completely just melted away right in front of us. It was such a horrible feeling at the end of the game. It was really weird, and I know we had to go around to see the fans, but it was, we just wanted the ground to lift up and just swallow us up.
And then when the dust settles on a disappointment like that, I'd imagine there's no way you think that's the last major tournament for more than 20 years. That must have been inconceivable at the time.
Well, for sure it was. I think, you know, I mean, I think a lot of us knew we were coming to the finale anyway. But where was the backup group, as we class it? Where is the younger generation coming to back us up to come in and fulfil and so we can sort of wean out and get out of it? And it wasn't happening. We didn't have a lot of potential in there. We had the potential, but we didn't have a lot of talent that was ready. And that was the downside of it. And players that came in getting opportunities, and you're thinking, yes, now that's it. Mark Burchill, for example, for Celtic's coming, I'm thinking, yes, now I'll get pushed out and go away now and go away in the wilderness. I thought, I'll enjoy it. And it wasn't happening. And you think, oh, no. And for the next 2 years, you're in and out, and you're thinking, right, there must be something will happen within the next 2 years. But I must admit, when I look back on it now, I did think at one stage I'll be going to watch Scotland at a World Cup or a Euros as a fan. I never thought I'd be actually scratching my head thinking, when's the next time we're going to do it?
What was that squad like to be a part of, though? You say, you know, that's the one you remember the most, that you can remember being a part of. It must have been littered with leaders, jokers as well, I would imagine. What was it like?
You had to be careful. That was a problem. You had to be very careful. You had everything, you know, you had your people in there, your mentors, a lot of leaders, a lot of people that spoke, a lot of people, we all had opinions, and we all argued. I wouldn't say we fought, but we had arguments, we had disagreements.
Those guys be then? Who'd be the main ones involved in that?
Gary McAllister, you've got Tom Boyd, you've got Colin Hendry, Colin Calderwood, you've got myself, you've got John Collins, you've got all these guys that had opinions about certain aspects of the game, and rightly so. But it was up to us to put them all together and do it the way the manager wanted. And we did in a lot of games, sometimes you have to have a disagreement to agree on something, and that's what happened. And we did it probably more so than anything, and that's what brought us together, because we were a club, because we knew I could argue with you, but then once we'd done it, it was over, it was gone. We'd solve that problem, and then you move on. Nobody ever had a burden about anybody. We all just got together, and then we went out, socialised, and then got back in, got the team spirit going again, played together, and off we went.
And then on the other hand, who are the guys that are keeping you on your toes, maybe providing a bit of comic relief when needed?
Billy McKinley is just mental. He's just mad. You know, I mean, I just knew what Badger was like. Dundee United for starters, and then all of a sudden he's my teammate at Blackburn, and you're thinking, I've got enough of him, and then he's your teammate with Scotland, and you think, oh my God. And you just know you've got to be on your toes with people like him. They just wind you up. Coisty, another one. So you've got, with so many different individuals that are doing different characters, and then you've got your quiet ones that will sit away from it. Sometimes I'd sit away just to watch people, how they got on with it, but it's just, you were always, even if you sat away from it, you were always brought into it. You were never sat away on your own, you never left on your own.
It was interesting to hear you saying after France, you thought, okay, maybe that's me, on the way out sort of thing, who's going to come and take my place? But Euro 2000 qualification comes around very quickly and still involved. We didn't really make it easy for ourselves en route to that playoff against England, did we?
No, it was very, very difficult. And then you've got England in the playoffs and everybody's dream. We were like, yes, we've got an opportunity here. Even though I know living down there, they just seen Scotland as this is going to be easy for us. But a Scotland-England game, I've been part of three or four of them. They're never easy and it's never works that way. And it still, even to this day, won't work that way. And we just had two hiccups, two set pieces. And we thought, what's happened? And we done everything regarding, we knew everything about them. We covered every single thing apart from Paul's goals, running from the halfway line and scoring two headers. Anybody else, we could accept it. But with Paul's goals, we couldn't accept that. We just didn't know what had happened. And that was a disappointing thing. We'd lost set piece goals again.
I don't know if you're the type to sort of have regrets, but when you look back on that, was there a feeling that we were close to a historic comeback in the?
Oh, we were. My biggest regret, I've got a regret, and that was chasing back Michael Owen and collecting my yellow card that takes me out of the game at Wembley. So from that point of view, for me, that was the downside of it. But I still believe that I still believe we'd beat England. We could have done, and apart from a top draw save for David Seaman for Christian Daly, from that point of view, that I think that was the proverbial kick in the shin.
I like how when we spoke about France, you said that that was your Scotland career coming to an end. Yet when the 2002 campaign comes around, you're still there, you're still involved, and yes. you score your final goal against Croatia in qualifying for that. What do you remember about that being the? You wouldn't have known at the time that it was the last one, but you do now. How do you reflect on it?
It wasn't actually nearly my last one. My last one was nearly my 50th cap. I nearly walked away from the national team in my 50th cap. After that, I had a fallout. I never had a fallout. We had a conversation with Craig about the game with San Marino, getting subbed in that game and being captain, and I was disappointed. And I just told Craig a few home truths, and we seen eye to eye. And for the next couple of days, we're going to Croatia, and I think Billy Dodds' wife, I think, was pregnant at the time, and I think Dodgy had to leave. So basically, with me being the way I was, Craig was felt under pressure from me of, I don't know where to play him or not, because he didn't know where I was going to be in the right frame of mind. And he kept, obviously, Colin would always have a meeting with Craig, and Colin come back and just, he'd always ask me stupid questions, and I knew he was actually fishing for Craig. And I says, of course I'm all right, I'm ready for the game, I'm up for it. I says, I don't care what happened in the last game. I says, I'm up for a game. I says, that's gone, that's history. And I went out, done what I normally done. I went, gave it 110%, and when Colin Cameron came up and produced the goods and set it on a plate for me, I was just thankful for it.
How do you look back on that then as an ending to the Scotland career, if you like? Because you said you perhaps knew it was coming in terms of the age you were, but the home truths that you speak about with Craig, does that sort of put any dampener on it at all, or was it just one of those things?
No, I think when you get to 50 caps, I'm thankful just to get to 50. I was thankful for my first one, but to get to 50 was unbelievable, and when you've got 2 years at the game with broken legs, that's the downside of it. But to get back to it all and have that argument, it probably was something that I needed to clear, get off my chest, maybe something that was building up in me, and it just came out. And probably speak to Craig, I probably never said booty a goose in the 12, 13 years I was in international setup with him. So from that point of view, it was obviously something that built up, and we got it off. And as I said, I went to Croatia, scored the goal, and I just thought, I knew then basically that my time was up without actually saying I'm retiring. Mm-hmm. So Craig asked me not to retire, so I didn't retire.
Right, some quick fire questions to finish us off. What was the best game you would say that you played for Scotland?
My best game personally, I would probably say Austria, by head and shoulders above it, and getting the two goals, and the manner of getting the goals, and knowing the preparation that we put in for that game to counteract against the sweeper system. For me, that was my personal best.
This is the one where you always disappoint your pals. Who was the one best player you played alongside for Scotland?
Best player I played alongside? God, we had so many with Scotland. You know, I mean, you're going to upset a lot. You know, playing with Coisty up front, Mo Johnson. You know, you got Gary McAllister. You even go back, you had Miller McLeish. I mean, these are all legends of the game. You know what I mean? I honestly, I'm going to go on the fence with that. I don't want to say one player because okay. I've got so many in that. It's brilliant.
And we're at Hampden, you might bump into some of them this afternoon, exactly. So you don't want to take the chance. I get that, that's fine. Okay. Best you played against then? You'll never meet these guys, so just pick one. Offend the rest if you want.
The best player I played against?
For Scotland, yeah.
Franco Baresi. He was unbelievable. I remember playing against him. It was Viale, his debut in Perugia. And Baresi played at the back with Costa Curta and Mo Johnson. And wee Mo was brilliant. And I'm strike with wee Mo. And wee Mo was one of the best for me, holding the ball up, setting people up. And wee Mo couldn't even get the ball. Baresi was taking it off him, going down the right wing, crossing it in. You're thinking, what's this guy doing? And just, I'm standing on the pitch watching and admiring this guy. I knew what he was like at AC Milan, and you heard about this system that they do, that they charge out, and then they all go back and they charge out. Done the same at Italy, and I first-hand experienced it, and I just thought, I've got to take my hat off to that guy, because he is unbelievable.
And just to round us off, how do you reflect as a whole on your Scotland career? You got to do something that not many Scottish footballers get to do, and you did it a number of times. How do you reflect on it?
To be fair, I love my time with Scotland. Absolutely loved it, you know, from the first cap to the 53rd cap. And the 2 years in the middle, just watching the national team progress, for me was phenomenal. I wouldn't turn the clock back for anything. You know, I wouldn't start again. The 53 caps I had, I've got great memories. Every single campaign I went to, I wish and I hope I'm going to go as a fan at one stage, and the sooner the better.
Kevin, thank you very much for your time. I'm sure everyone will agree it was a brilliant trip down memory lane listening to some of Kevin's stories. If you want more where that came from, please subscribe to all the other episodes of the Official Scotland podcast. You can do that on any of your usual podcast sites.